Before we begin our argument on our first case today, I wanted to let you all know that Justice Crooks is not going to be in the courtroom today. He generally sits in the chair between Justice Abrahamson and Justice Ziegler. He won't be with us today here, but he is watching on Wisconsin Eye, so we can all give Justice Crooks a high five. He was present at our conference that we always have before we begin a case just a little bit ago, and he will participate in the conference that we plan to have after our cases are finished for today. So he is going to be participating in the case this morning, but just in a little different manner than he does sometimes in the past. Now, often we
have to say his participation this morning and this afternoon will be by telephone conference call. It's not that he's personally appearing, you know, at 9 o'clock and then disappearing and then coming back.
Okay, we often have students from court with class for these presentations, and I don't have a note from the marshal that we have any class here today. Is that correct? There are no students today? Or do we have a class? Okay. Would you please... those persons who are present from a class, on court with class, will you please, okay, Fox Valley Technical, there you go. Fox Valley Technical, if you are here, the students from that class and the teacher who provided the materials to you, will you all please stand so we can recognize you? Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming. We appreciate your joining us this morning. You may be seated. Are there any other students from any other class who are here today? All right, very good. Now, before I call the case, I want to let you know that in the past, the court sometimes has not paid very good attention to the red lights which go on. And your students should know that the lawyers get a green light when they begin, a yellow light when they have 5 minutes to go, and a red light when they're to sit down and to stop discussing their case with the court. And the lawyers are routinely excellent. They follow the lights very well. However, sometimes the court does not behave so well, and we continue to ask questions way after the red light has been on for some time. What that does is it tends to give one side of the argument more time than the other. And when we begin our arguments, we give 30 minutes to each side. So if we ask a lot of questions after the red light goes on, we have a concern that we're not being fair and even-handed to both sides. So we're going to try very hard to mind the lights today, just like the counsel will do. So I'll call now our first case, Winnebago County versus Christopher, case number 141048. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel? Please do.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Caitlin Lamb, and I represent Christopher S. Under Wisconsin Statute 5120-1AR, an individual in prison may be civilly committed and medicated without a finding of dangerousness. I ask that this court hold that the statute violates substantive due process because it does not require a finding of dangerousness at any point. This holding is supported by case law.
First, now, this statute has two parts, right? Confinement and medication.
Well, to be clear, the commitment is under 5120-1AR, and then there is a separate statute that specifically addresses the medication, and that's 5161. So there are two separate statutes.
Okay, what are we arguing about here, the commitment or the medication or both? What's unconstitutional?
Christopher is explicitly asserting that the commitment statute, the 5120-1AR, is unconstitutional.
Okay, he's already in commitment. He's committed to state prison.
Yes, and Your Honor, just to be clear, since the completion of briefing in this case, it's my understanding that his prison sentence has the confinement portion has ended and he's currently out on extended supervision. And it's my understanding that right now he is not currently under a commitment. However, the county can provide more information since I unfortunately don't have access.
Well, he's not in prison, right?
Correct, but he is currently on extended supervision.
And is he committed now?
It's my understanding that he is not currently under.
So he's not in prison, and he's not committed. And we're discussing that, was his commitment valid under
yes.
the under the statute? Because the statute may be unconstitutional. If it's unconstitutional, then the commitment was unconstitutional.
Yes, and this is still significant to him for a number of reasons. First of all, since he is currently on extended supervision, at any point he could be revoked and be sent back to prison, at which point the statute would be applicable to him. Additionally, there's case law that indicates that the stigma of a commitment continues to carry on even after the commitment has ended.
That argument goes to you don't want the court to get rid of this case on mootness.
Yes, and that's correct. Plus, the third reason being, in addition to the stigma and the fact that he could, in fact, be revoked, is also that if a commitment is sought while under extended supervision, it's still possible that I believe this commitment could be used against him in those proceedings or brought up at court. So I do not think that this case is moot to him by any means, since there are still consequences.
Counsel, I'm glad that that Justice Abramson brought that up, because sometimes the court in its conversations and counsel in their conversations and in briefing might use as an analogous argument the treatment issue. But I would like counsel to be very careful to keep it separate and distinct, because we are only addressing 5121AR in this case, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would just add that I do believe that the medication is involved because it is a direct consequence of the commitment. Generally, especially in the instance of an individual in prison, it seems that the commitment is sought for the purpose of medication. So I do think that the fact that once you are committed under the statute, it's really important that after the county can also seek that medication order. So I think that they are very intertwined in that respect.
Okay, I want you to be careful with that, only because having issued these kinds of orders, they are separate and distinct orders for which separate and distinct findings exist. And so if you do want the court to do what you just said, that's a very different argument than what you initially started out. And that's why I think Justice Abramson started out her comments that way. Are you talking medication and treatment order, or are you talking the commitment? And as I dissected this case, I really do think it is a commitment case, which is a separate statute with separate verbiage and a separate order, right?
Yes, I do agree. It's just my position, though, that it is, I respectfully disagree, it's my position that it is still should be considered. I mean, it is a consequence.
All right. Then tell me what you want us to consider. Are you asking us to consider the separate statute, too, on involuntary treatment? I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I just want to know what we're talking about today. Or is it what you said, which is 1AR?
You are correct. I am specifically asking that the court find that the 1AR is unconstitutional.
Okay. But as part of your argument, you're saying in part because later other orders could issue and that kind of thing. Is that how that comes in?
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly it. Okay. It's a result. And so I'd like the court to just keep that in mind when they are considering. But I am specifically asking to find that the 1AR is unconstitutional.
Okay, thank you.
Are you also asking us to consider whether the patient's rights under 5161 were properly applied to Christopher?
Yes, I do have a second argument regarding that. I allege that the county had not provided sufficient evidence or had not proven by clear and convincing evidence that Christopher was incompetent to refuse the medication.
Correct.
So okay. That is a separate. So there are two arguments. The primary argument, though, being that the 5121 AR is in fact unconstitutional.
Right.
Perhaps the confusion arises because this is a certification, and the order that this court issued accepted the certification. And so it doesn't come to us by way of petition for review. The certified question, at least as presented and approved in the order, is the question presented, this is from the first page of the certification by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, the question presented is whether WSSTAT 5121AR is facially unconstitutional on substantive due process grounds because it does not require that a court find an inmate dangerous prior to ordering the inmate civilly committed for treatment and authorizing the involuntary medication of the inmate. So is that the question we are addressing here today, the certified question, or are we addressing something else?
Well, I am specifically just asking that the court address the commitment, but I certainly think there was no argument in the briefs addressing the medication statute, so I believe that could be a case for a different day. So here, specifically just challenging the commitment.
Okay, so you would you would ask the court to modify that. Let me ask you, do you want this question to stand as certified or do you want it modified?
I believe it if it would make it more clear, then I would request the modification, just based on the brief that I did only specifically challenge the commitment. There was not an argument set forth that the medication statute was facially unconstitutional or unconstitutional as applied.
The second issue then is set forth, I think, in footnote 10 of the certification, and that deals with whether the county failed to show by clear and convincing evidence that he was incompetent to refuse medication or treatment because the testimony presented at the hearing on this issue merely parroted the statutory language without providing detail, et cetera. And that's the second issue you want us to address.
And that is a sufficiency of the evidence.
Sufficiency of evidence question.
So,
is there an issue as to the level of scrutiny on the constitutional claim?
Well, it's Christopher's position that regardless of the level of scrutiny applied, that the statute is still unconstitutional. However, if this court does decide that in this particular case they would like to address the level of scrutiny, we would ask that intermediate scrutiny be applied, particularly because of the interests involved. Inmates have a powerful interest in avoiding being classified as mentally ill and also subsequently becoming being medicated against their will. So regardless, though, I do think that the statute is unconstitutional, even if the lowest standard, the rational basis, is applied.
On page 13 of your brief, you argue for the intermediate level of review. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. If the court does decide, or the court should adopt the intermediate or higher standard, as I was saying, just because of the interest involved here in avoiding the classification of being treated as mentally ill or and the administration of medication. However, once again, even under the lowest standard, this statute is unconstitutional because it does not require the finding of dangerousness. So if rational basis would be applied, the statute just it's not reasonably related. Because if there's no finding of dangerousness, then there's no relation to the state's interest in a prison.
What is not reasonably related to what? Why don't you start articulating it? Yes.
The statute, so the 5121 AR, would not be
reasonably related to
the state's interest in safety and security within the prison.
In the prisons.
And the reason for that would simply be because the statute doesn't require any finding of dangerousness whatsoever. There's no dangerousness required. And so without that, there's just no relation to safety.
Wouldn't that be within the purview of the legislature to make that determination, that policy determination, that in the prison setting, there will not necessarily need to be that finding, that in the prison setting, the need for the state to have regulation and order, especially when it comes to, among others, the mentally ill, that they will do away with the need for the dangerousness requirement. Why wouldn't that be rationally related to the orderly administration of the prison system?
Well, so first of all, I think the case law clearly indicates that there needs to be a finding of mental illness and dangerousness. And so based on that, I do believe that there has to, the statute without that finding of dangerousness would be constitutional.
Well, you're switching to a statutory argument, but you started out with a constitutional issue about rational relationship.
Yes, the statute is unconstitutional because it doesn't have this finding of dangerousness. And so,
well, you first have to find a state interest. What do you think the state interest is that could be sustained here?
Right? My understanding from the county's brief and the non-party state brief was that there was an interest, or the interest claimed was the safety and security in a prison setting. And so my position is that...
Why isn't the state's interest in helping the inmates? That's another interest. And if you see an inmate mentally has mental health issues, then the state, who has this person segregated, I don't mean in solitary segregation, but segregated from the general population, has a person who looks mentally ill or is mentally ill, and therefore the state wants to help them, right? It's like having parents parentia, that you've taken this person out of the population, you now owe them an obligation to give them a medical treatment. That's the state's interest.
Well, I think that, the state does have an interest in care and treatment. There's a specific United States Supreme Court case, O'Connor, which indicates that even though the state has an interest in providing care or treatment to a person, there still needs to be that requirement of dangerousness. Additionally, I think that...
Why is that? Is it because if a person doesn't want medical care, should have it, you can't force it on them? Is that the concept?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. That they do have, there is a case, Washington versus Harper, which indicates that an inmate or a convicted person does have a liberty interest in refusing this unwanted medication or treatment, which, as I was referencing before, is a consequence of the commitment. And so...
Right, we're talking about the commitment, which then authorizes
what, yes,
sets the stage.
Yes, correct.
But then the concept is you don't commit him because he's not dangerous, and if he wants to be mentally ill and not get treatment, that's his personal business. That's your argument, isn't it?
Yes, and there's also another interest, too, in just in BTEC versus Jones, the United States Supreme Court indicated that there's an interest in the liberty interest in avoiding a transfer to a mental hospital from the prison setting. So I think that there are...
Well, that can't be that much of an interest. He's already not free to leave. I mean, he's already in confinement. Why is it so important that he have a liberty interest in being in prison rather than in a mental institution?
Well, the confinement is much different than the commitment or the mental health finding that somebody is mentally ill and dangerous. It's just separate consequences. So freedom from confinement does not necessarily mean that you can then commit somebody, find them mentally ill, and then involuntarily medicate them against their will. And so that's just circling back the reason that the dangerousness is so important here, because without dangerousness, there is no connection to the state's interest in the safety and security. So this statute, as it is unconstitutional. That's not to say, though, that the legislature couldn't come back and modify the statute to include some finding of dangerousness, or alternatively, I'm not saying that an inmate could never be committed. There's certainly the five other commitment standards that the county could proceed under.
And you know, counsel, four questions ago you were interrupted when you were about to articulate your reason for why the commitment statute would not be rationally related to the state's articulated purpose of orderly administration and safety and security in the prison system. And I'm interested, you were interrupted just as you were about to say, why not? And I'm interested in your response, so please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. So what I was saying that if somebody is dangerous, not dangerousness, so they may be mentally ill, but they're minding their own business, they're not harming themselves, they're not harming others, they're not causing a disruption. Without that, there's just no connection to be able to say that the state has this, you know, it's not related to the state's interest in the safety and security. And so that's why in order for there to be a really reasonable relationship, so a relationship to safety and security would require the dangerousness. Because if somebody is dangerous in the prison setting, it would make sense then that the state has this interest in safety and security and would administer the medication.
Is that where we should hold the line in the prison system, that the orderly administration of the prison system under what I heard you just say cannot be disrupted unless the inmate exhibits dangerousness, I assume you would say to self or others, or maybe not even self, maybe you would say just others, when, is that true?
Well, to be clear, yeah. You know, if an inmate is acting out or causing commotion, there are certainly disciplinary measures that can be taken, segregation, I know they have probably...
The state would not have a rational interest in avoiding putting someone in solitary confinement, for instance, if they're suffering from mental illness. They're schizophrenic, they have severe mental illness, they cannot recognize reality. So it would be more rational to take that person and put them in solitary than it would be to commit them under the civil statute. And there can only be a commitment, from what I hear you saying, if they're exhibiting some kind of dangerous behavior as opposed to disruptive. Disruptive, they go to the whole dangerousness, they can be civilly committed.
Yes, and the reason for that is because I believe that the civil commitment, because medication is a direct result about that, it's a bodily intrusion. They're administering these drugs, which often carry these serious side effects. You know, some of the psychotropic drugs can have long-term issues on your health.
Now we're kind of blending the statutes again, aren't we? I thought at the beginning of your presentation you said you're simply arguing the commitment. Now you want to jump over that and you want to go to medication.
Counsel, I need to jump in and try to clarify that again because those are two separate court orders, two separate statutes. And when you say Andy's committed and Andy's involuntarily medicated, those don't always go hand in hand. You can be committed and not be involuntarily medicated, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
It just happens to be that in this case, with the three-party petition and the previous tries at less restrictive means and the doctor's reports and the hearing that was had on this, that the court then concluded, given all the evidence in front of the court, that this person met the legal standard for commitment and separately that this person met the legal standard for involuntary medication, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Part of what happens in your argument, which is why I mentioned this from the beginning, is keep saying, and he was committed, and so he's medicated. Those are very different things, right?
Yes, you're correct, Your Honor. This instance, and I think in general, though, I pointed out a few cases in the brief where the commitment order and then the direct result is the medication. I think also that the statute, I mean, if you look at the commitment statute, it talks about treatment. And so,
well, you're committed for treatment. I mean, you're not just committed and left there never to be treated, but treatment isn't always involuntary medication. You have to meet a whole different standard for that.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Just, as I was saying earlier, I do think that's important, that it's one of the consequences. But even just looking at the commitment alone, I mean, there's a stigma attached to it by somebody saying, I've been committed versus I'm just taking the medication. So I think that it is a direct result.
Where was he serving his sentence before he was committed?
I believe he was confined in 2005. He was at Fox Lake up until 2012, and I do not believe he had been receiving any type of medication. And then he was transferred to the Wisconsin Resource Center, and I believe right around that time the petition in this case was filed.
Right. That's what I was looking back at. Thank you.
Now, it seems to me the question that an underlying question here is, the prison Department of Corrections is the expert and has the authority and obligation to run the prisons, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Under the state statutes, and you're not debating that, right?
No.
And if I hear this right, why can't the state say, in its brief, it's the county, but why can't the government say, under those circumstances, that the prison system has the power to do what it thinks is needed to run it well?
Well,
and if that is its power, then this is rationally related. Committing him, is rationally related.
I think that there still needs to be, under all the United States Supreme Court cases, I think that there needs to be a finding of dangerousness. Neither the county nor the state has indicated any case that has found that it is okay to commit or medicate an individual without that finding. Additionally, I would note that
the court didn't make that finding. It's right in the order, and it's all over in the doctor's reports. I'm trying to get how you think this wasn't a dangerous person.
Well, this case was a jury trial, and so there was never, the jury was asked five questions in this case, and the jury was never asked to find whether or not Christopher was in fact dangerous. In addition, I would note that I am making a facial challenge. I'm not discussing an as-applied to the particular facts of this case. So there was no finding of dangerousness in this case, and that I believe is required. And additionally, it wouldn't take that much more in terms of resources, maybe another question or two to the expert who already had to testify just to prove that the inmate is dangerous. I am by no means saying, once again, that inmates cannot be committed whatsoever. It's just that the statute as it is, there's just not enough. There's no finding of dangerousness, which I believe is contrary to the United States Supreme Court cases, all which require.
What cases are you relying on? You cite Harper, you discussed Harper. What other United States Supreme Court cases require a finding of dangerousness for the civil commitment?
Versus Donaldson would be one example, and there the United States Supreme Court specifically stated that a state cannot constitutionally confine without more a non-dangerous individual. There's also Fosha versus Louisiana, stating it's unconstitutional for a state to continue to confine a harmless mentally ill person. So this statute, in a sense, because there's no finding of dangerousness, it's allowing for commitment solely on the basis of the mental illness. And so I'm asserting that under the case law, there needs to be that additional finding required of dangerousness. And once again, I am not aware of any case that has indicated that it's okay just solely based on mental illness to commit.
Counselor, he was convicted of mayhem, and that's what he was confined to prison for. Does it matter the charge for which he was imprisoned when we look at your concern about there being no explicit finding of dangerousness, or can we impute dangerousness from certain convictions?
The red light is on. Do you want her to answer that in her
rebuttal
or now?
Well, I think she can answer it now. Thank you.
Sure. So just because somebody has been convicted of a crime, I don't believe that it automatically means that the person is dangerous. There are plenty of people who are in prison who have been convicted of, say, like a theft or a forgery that wouldn't necessarily follow under the dangerousness statute set forth in prison. And so I think that's the problem by saying just because somebody's been convicted. The second point being that, for instance, in this case, he was convicted, it was in 2005, and this petition was not filed until much later, 2012. And This court in Wood had stated that if there's a finding of dangerousness, it has to be a present. And so I think that just by simply saying that because somebody has a conviction, that must mean they're dangerous, I think that's not, it's too broad. And so I think there needs to be a finding that the jury would make if there was a case. And so for that reason, I would ask that this court would find the 5121AR unconstitutional.
I have a question. In a court-ordered report, the report, and it must have been a medical type of report, that stated that he is seen as a high risk of violence. But the report also stated he is not a dangerous person. And then it reported, stated he meets the dangerous criteria. So is there evidence in this record that is he's shown really as dangerous?
Which report?
Other than that report, which I found confusing because it looked to me like there were typos, there wasn't actually any evidence that was submitted at trial in the case. I would also direct your attention to...
Which doctor's report was that? I just don't have the
J.R. Musunru, and there was also another report. I would just note Michalowski, one of the first reports that was submitted prior to the probable cause hearing, that specifically stated that he has not exhibited any dangerous behavior or made any specific threats. And so I think that the reports, most of them indicate there is no suicide attempts, there was no threats to harm somebody else. There is the one report which I found confusing, but regardless, at least at trial, the jury was never asked to find he was dangerous. That was not a finding required.
Your blue brief at page, I think it's 5, states what the jury found. Mentally ill, proper subject for treatment, need of treatment, inmate, appropriate, less restrictive forms, not successful, and 5, that he was fully informed. That's what the jury findings were, nothing about dangerousness.
Yes, that's correct.
And now, I also have another
my position
question.
That none of those requirements.
Okay. I would urge you to ask the question in rebuttal so we're fair to both sides here.
Okay. You made a motion to strike the county's brief in part. Right?
Yes, that's correct.
And that motion was held pending oral argument. And in order to give the county an opportunity, because they only have one shot here, you have two, what's your position? Is it still you want that struck?
Yes, just because an as-applied challenge was not raised in this case at the Court of Appeals, and it was not raised in the Supreme Court.
I
asked that the court strike to avoid any confusion.
Your challenge is only facial, but the county says addresses both facial and as applied.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. And that's still your position.
Thank you.
Please the court. My name is James Carney. I am a solo practitioner in Nina. For the last 26 years, I have had, the pleasure, if you want to call it that, of representing Winnebago County in all Chapter 51 proceedings. I am probably the only corporation counsel that uses this section. In fact, I'm relatively sure that I'm the only corporation counsel that uses this section. So you are talking to the sole individual that has had the experience to do that.
But I don't understand that. Does that mean only Winnebago County commits under 1AR?
Probably, Your Honor. And that's because...
What does everyone else do?
Well, they don't have a Wisconsin Resource Center in their county.
And that's where he was institutionalized.
What physically happens is, of course, we've got, of course, all of the Department of Corrections institutions throughout the state. When they identify an inmate who has a mental health issue... that feels that they need some sort of treatment, that individual is transferred to the Wisconsin Resource Center. I have never seen it happen that another county has filed a petition, although technically they could, not suggesting that they wouldn't have that ability, but because of the procedure the prison system has, they all end up in Winnebago County, and I would be responsible for filing those petitions.
Do you think that's in part because before anyone could be committed, they need to take efforts to deal with inmates who may have difficulties in the prison setting with less restrictive means before they resort to sending them to a place like Wisconsin Resource Center?
Yes. Wisconsin Resource is very much more well-suited to provide those things to the inmate. They're, again, the folks there, actually the Wisconsin Resource Center is technically not under the Department of Corrections. It's technically under the Department of Health and Human Services, although there isn't anyone there, I believe, at this time who is not an inmate. There are both men and women there, by the way. But the individuals at the Resource Center all have special training, you know, from the psychiatrists, where there's certainly many more psychiatrists at the Wisconsin Resource Center that you would find at any of the other facilities. There are psychologists, there are social workers, what they call the guards, which are PCT workers. All of them have specialized training in dealing with the mentally individuals with mental health issues, and as a result of that, I think that goes to attempting to give them less restrictive alternatives. There is more programming and services available to them there that are specifically dealing with that in preparation for a commitment. I might add that there's probably over, I'm going to guess the last time I asked the doctor this, he'd indicated that there was probably over 400 inmates at the Wisconsin Resource Center, and I can obviously tell the court that probably less than 20% of them ultimately get committed. So most of them do benefit from that care and treatment that they are being provided.
How many inmates are there in the state, if you know?
I do not know that.
Thousands.
I would guess thousands, yes, many thousands, tens of thousands.
Can I just direct your attention briefly to the section that Justice Abramson was talking about in the report to the court, that there was some discussion of with counsel? There was the history of present illness section where it talks about the transfer from Fox Lake to the Resource Center in July of 2012. Then I think around November of 2012, the commitment proceedings began. And then that was based on the three-party petitions. So three people came forward and said, this person's in need of more than we can do here. And then they filed several reports, but the one that was being cited to, while it does have some typos, in the present illness section, it talks about how this person believes his roommate and his family members sexually assault him and try to assert sexual dominance, accusing roommates of planning to kill him, accusing them of being raped by different people countless times, being raped at any time. He made threats to kill his roommate due to unprovoked behavior and current delusions, seen as a high risk of violence, and transferred then to WRC, the Resource Center. And then they said he continues to exhibit delusions and refused to take medications, and so he still feels people are doing bad things, that he's not a dangerous person, he doesn't mind if it's sort of confusing of protection, but it transfers into what he thinks, as far as I read this report.
Is that the report from the psychologist from the state treatment facility?
The doctor that Ms. M-U-S-U-N-U-R.
That would be Dr. Musunuro. Yeah.
That's the one that counsel said was submitted to the jury and seemed to be confusing as to, you know, that there was an evidence of dangerousness. Do you agree that that's the report and that's what the jury
I would agree heard? That is the report. I've struggled with this for years with regard to doctors who are doing independent reports. Dr. Musunuro, as well as the other independent doctor, typically get the same court order from our courts indicating that they are to evaluate the individual, make a report, and ultimately make recommendations. That's indeed what Dr. Musunuro did. Frankly, Dr. Musunuro doesn't understand 5120 sub 1 sub AR. Although he expanded on all of that, Frankly, that information was not necessary for purposes of my commitment under AR, because AR does not require a finding of dangerousness, as Ms. Lamb has indicated. Just because an individual is committed under AR doesn't mean they're not dangerous. It simply means that's not proof that's required at trial. It's not something the jury is going to find. In fact, I suppose if I attempted to do that, I would end up with an argument that it's not relevant. Because technically under AI, there is no finding of dangerousness.
And you think that's okay? You don't have to have a finding of dangerous to commit
I think that's okay.
There are two issues here, as we have clarified initially. Maybe there's a third, that is the motion to strike. But setting that aside for a moment, the issue regarding sufficiency of evidence was set forth in the footnote at the very end of the certification by the Court of Appeals, footnote 5, I guess it is. Normally, we don't take cases just involving sufficiency of evidence because it's error correcting. On the main issue, and I'll say the main issue is the constitutional issue, the Court of Appeals in its certification states, a facial challenge to the constitutionality of a statute implicates subject matter jurisdiction. Because the statute is challenged on its face, we do not recite the particular facts of Christopher's commitment, but instead immediately proceed to describe the legal issue. Are any facts necessary to decide the facial challenge to this statute, the constitutional facial challenge?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Again, I guess if of course it's Christopher's position that he's not dangerous, that would be a fact. But again, that's not part of the statute. So I would have to agree. I don't think there are any facts that we necessarily have to look at to determine whether or not AR is facially unconstitutional, other than those facts that might be necessary to suggest that the state does have an interest in finding these individuals are in need of some form of treatment and trying to convince them that they should accept that treatment. And
nothing particular to this defendant, nothing as applied, if I can use that term.
No, and in fact, as to that applied issue, I had indicated to Ms. Lamb earlier that, again, to avoid confusion, I would withdraw that portion in my argument from my brief. I'm not objecting to that.
Okay, that was my
notes. I had intended to say that first, but I didn't get to it.
I didn't get
the question right away.
Good. That was going to be my segue, so we've got that cleaned up. Thank you.
Counsel, could I ask subject statute, how long has that been part of our law?
Section, I always call it AR, so apologize. It's 5120.20 sub 1 sub AR. I call it AR. That's been a law since 1983, Your Honor, about 2 years before I was in these chambers, to be admitted. But it's been on the books a long time. I do find it somewhat surprising that this issue hasn't been raised before. I don't agree that it is facially unconstitutional, but it's been on the books for some 33 years now.
If I may follow up. On a relatively recent visit to Taycheedah, probably five or six years ago, I was struck by a large number of prisoners being in a special section, being shackled to tables and chairs. And the explanation is that all of these people were mentally ill and that there were problems getting them from Taycheedah to the Wisconsin Resource Center. And I was told that by numerous people. Were they mistaken, or what was going on? Why, do you know what?
I'm trying to recall. The Wisconsin Resource Center had a multi-million-dollar improvement some years ago. I want to say it was actually less than 5 or 6 years ago. There are women inmates now at the Wisconsin Resource Center, so although I have nothing to do with the Department of Corrections, I would certainly hope that if those individuals are indeed believed to be mentally ill, that those women inmates have and will be transferred to the Wisconsin Resource Center. Unfortunately, that is one of the, I guess, the negative consequences that could occur should this court determine that AR is facially unconstitutional, is, you know, we would lose that ability to potentially treat them, to help them to identify that they have a mental illness and provide them with the necessary services. Of course, we've still got to convince them to some extent, and I think that's what AR is all about to some extent, and that's why I think it's facially constitutional, because it's not just about, well, we commit you and then we give you medications. As Justice Ziegler has indicated, I have committed a number, certainly it's a minority, so I'm not going to inflate that number, but I have committed quite a number of individuals under this statute, and I have not requested a medication order. Through this process, we have been able to help them understand and convince them that they have a need for treatment. And they, some of them, and again, it's certainly a smaller number than the majority, do agree to ultimately take that. They will come to a final hearing, for instance, and simply stipulate.
You know what's in part interesting about this case? Unfortunately, I mean, sentenced a lot of people. There are a lot of mentally ill people in our prisons. A number of people would actually prefer to be found in a position where they would receive mental health services on a more regular basis and seek, for example, a not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, or at sentencing urge, judge, this person's really not criminal, they don't belong in the criminal system, they belong in the mental health system. There aren't the resources there to deal with all the people that need that kind of help. But part of why I think we haven't seen this issue is because most people would prefer to be in the mental health system to the prison system. So this is kind of an unusual case in that regard.
Well, it is. You know, I can't speak for the motives of the inmates who choose to challenge these. I could throw a few things out, and I'm not going to do that here. But I guess you have to realize the type of folks that we're dealing with. Again, Christopher had been convicted of mayhem as a repeater. The record is pretty clear that, you know, he believed that the military had done certain things to him and that he was being controlled by them. And so perhaps, you know, in some instances they feel it's a matter of control. But I would agree, and just so I can make one point clear, when we're doing an AR, those initial reports that are done both by the licensed psychiatrist within the prison system, and then there's a second report done by a licensed psychologist from a state treatment facility. So this is someone that the resource center has to draw off of from either Mendota Mental Health or from Winnebago Mental Health, who is, of course, not connected in any way with the prison system. One of the focuses that they do is to identify what is the appropriate placement for this individual. And it gets a little bit confusing because the Wisconsin Resource Center is considered an outpatient treatment facility, whereas Winnebago Mental Health Institute and Mendota are considered inpatient treatment facilities. Don't be confused by the word out and in. I would suggest to you that the Resource Center is much more secure than Winnebago Mental Health or Mendota.
How many beds are there at Winnebago Mental Health, roughly?
Well, there's a lot of beds at Winnebago Mental Health, but, Your Honor, I can't recall even the last time we had an inmate transferred there. We have had, in the course of 26 years of my doing this job, I would say that I've had maybe three or four inmates that have been transferred to Mendota. For all of the other hundreds that I have done, they typically remain at the Wisconsin Resource Center on an outpatient basis.
Counsel, I'd like to turn to what the United States Supreme Court has said on the issue or other relevant court cases, because it does control. The Court of Appeals cited Harper, the United States Supreme Court case. Your opposing counsel, I think, cited Donaldson and maybe the Foscia case versus Louisiana for the premise or the proposition that dangerousness is required. And so if you would address the legal argument.
In my brief, I did distinguish the latter cases you mentioned. I think Harper is really the case on point, so let me concentrate on that for a moment. Harper basically stands for the proposition, and that case was in 1990, I believe, Your Honor, says that, and it was a prison regulation, it wasn't a statute. I don't think that's terribly relevant for our purposes today. But it indicated that an inmate who is mentally ill, gravely disabled, or dangerousness, or had a level of dangerousness, and that was perhaps expanded on that a little bit more, but it said, so it's mentally ill, gravely disabled, or dangerous, then automatically we can provide medications or treatment on an involuntary basis. It's a one-step process. That's how I would distinguish this case.
Didn't it also have language, I don't have it right in front of me, but although it was a involuntary administration of the medication, it had some language after that discussion about it applies to commitment as well, or this discussion? I thought that it did.
I don't recall that. I guess my point, again, would be that that's a one-step process. Wisconsin has a two-step process. And actually, I think your decision in Wood is somewhat similar to Harper in some regards, because, again, under 971, it's somewhat of a one-step process that we get right away to the medication issue. That does not happen in an AR situation, as Justice Ziegler has, I think, pointed out and took some of the wind out of my sail here, that it's a two-step process. We're first going to commit this individual, and if we later determine by separate hearing and order, and typically they're done at the same time, so I don't want to say it's totally separate, then we can find the individual incompetent and order some form of involuntary treatment, which may include medications. But it's not guaranteed, and as I've indicated, there are certainly occasions where that is not the case. And when we're dealing with a facial challenge, I think this court has to find that it cannot be enforced under any circumstances. And I don't think that is the case here. The other point I would just briefly make with regard to Harper is that there was also a presumption that Harper was competent.
Harper, as I understood your argument, that you seem to concede or acknowledge that for purposes of involuntary administration of medication, that it requires dangerousness.
It's certainly possible, Your Honor, that could be the result. I'm not going to deny that. I think there could be one slight exception to that if I was standing here arguing that, and that's what I was just going to say, because Harper presumes competence. And if we take away that presumption, Harper doesn't really tell us, well, what are you going to do if the individual is incompetent? And, you know, I don't know if the folks that drafted this law back in 1983 were thinking of that. Obviously, they had none of the guidance of these cases. But to some extent, I think it was quite brilliant to separate the two.
I think you and the defense counsel agree that the issue here is commitment.
Correct.
And that treatment can be separate. Many times it's not. It's one, maybe in one. Too far.
Be separate.
Pardon me?
Forced treatment or involuntary treatment would be separate.
Yes, but usually or many times it's in the same order, and the reason you're committing is so that you can get to the treatment.
Right.
So there's a connection, but both of you have separated out the connection, and we're dealing only with commitment here, if I understand the case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And your position is you can commit even though there's no finding of dangerousness.
Yes.
Right? So what is the rational basis argument of what is this? To get rational basis, you have to find what is the state interest, right?
Correct.
What is the state doing? What's the state action?
Well.
And how are the two related, right? Or are they rationally related? Does the state action push forward the state interest, and it's a very deferential treatment? So a very deferential standard. So what's the state's interest here? in commitment.
Well, I think
the state's action is to commit. So what's the rational
basis? And foremost, I think the state has to be in the position of the parent, as you had indicated later, and has definitely an interest in making sure that those inmates are taken care of. Okay. So I think that should be, honestly, I believe that should be first and foremost. I'm putting safety and security of the facility somewhere underneath that. Clearly, individuals who are in prison, we have to treat them if they have diabetes. We have to treat them if they have some cardiac problem.
If they don't want to be treated for the diabetes and they say, hey, I know I'm physically ill. I know that diabetes can be a dangerous disease. I know you're offering me care. I don't want it. And that's care, not commitment.
And there certainly are those that have that, and I had one yesterday. And what I do then is I do a guardianship on them, Your Honor.
All right. But you can't force treatment unless you can set up an incompetence in some fashion. That's what you mean by guardianship.
Correct.
Else
they would have
okay.
to be either incompetent under 54
right.
or 54.
So is it the same thing in mental health, that if the prisoner is has a mental health issue but does not want to treat it and is not dangerous to self or to the population, you can treat them anyway? And the treatment here is, I'm not talking about the drugs, I'm talking about commitment.
I believe that you can commit him, yes. Treatment is a different issue.
Why can you commit him? What is the relationship between the state interest in inmate care and the commitment? Isn't that what we're trying to do? And if I'm wrong on the state interest or I'm wrong on the state action?
Yeah, I guess my feeling on that is that the state interest is making sure that they are taken care of.
Right. Okay.
Now, they may not agree with that, but that still is the state interest.
That's right. But they can't force me to take diabetes medication, but you can't, unless you can get me declared incompetent in some form under guardianship.
And we do that.
Why can you force me to get mental health care? If I'm quietly in, I mean, may not be this prisoner, but if I'm quietly in my cell, obeying all orders, I have mental illness, but I'm not causing any problems to myself or anywhere else, why can you force me to be committed? Did you appoint a guardian for this person?
I'm sorry?
Does he have a guardian?
Christopher did not have a guardian. There are very few. On occasion, there are some that do, but Christopher did not.
Did he have a lawyer?
Yes, he had a lawyer from immediately appointed at the point of the filing of the petition.
Mm-hmm. And what was the lawyer's position?
With regard to?
Commitment.
Well, I don't know. Her position was that she needed to represent Christopher's position, which was to contest the commitment. I don't know what her position was, but other than that she needed to do what he had asked her to do.
What argument did she make that he was right? I mean, you said he had a lawyer.
The evidence was somewhat overwhelming, so I think she was hard-pressed to make a significant argument that he was not mentally ill, which I would also point out is not necessarily an easy thing to prove. In order to find somebody mentally ill, we need to prove that they have a substantial disorder in either thought, mood, perception, orientation, or memory, which is grossly impairing either their judgment, their behavior, their ability to meet the demands of life, or their capacity to recognize reality. I continually struggle with attempting to prove that relatively high burden to a jury.
There isn't a challenge here to the lawyer's actions during this case or
only
the jury trial or not being a zealous advocate, is there?
The only objection was that the trial attorney was ineffective for failing to raise this constitutional issue,
but not because the trial lawyer wasn't an advocate, right?
Well, he wasn't an advocate. It was not an advocate because he didn't raise a constitutional issue, or she wasn't an advocate. Isn't that the ineffective assistance of counsel?
In her defense, I would indicate to the court that in the 200 or 300, and probably at least 300 of these cases I've done, I've not yet have one attorney raise that issue. So if we're going to use the reasonable attorney standard, I hardly think she was in inadequate or ineffective.
Counselor, you were asked whether we could ignore the facts of this case early on, but the focus then was whether or not the statute was facially unconstitutional for not having a finding of dangerousness required, correct?
Correct.
But you just told us a bit ago that you'd have to have the facts in order to do the basic foundation of mental illness so that there could be a commitment in the first instance.
That's correct.
And there are also facts that, as I understand them, are disputed by opposing counsel as being insufficient to meet the burden to show that involuntary medication was required, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so we still have to keep the facts in mind to a limited degree.
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel, the second issue deals with whether or not the statutory requirement has been met, the finding that is that medication is required to clear satisfactory and convincing evidence. That's the middle standard in the civil proof, the burden of proof. But here we have a constitutional issue, and there is apparently a dispute as to what is the level of scrutiny, strict, rational basis, or the middle level. What's your position and why?
My position, as well as the Attorney General's position, was that it should be a rational basis review. That would be the level of scrutiny. That was what appeared to be the level of scrutiny in Harper, which I think is the case at least closest on point to this. But I might actually agree with Ms. Lamb that I'm not terribly convinced that it matters if you use the intermediate burden or the rational burden. I take a different position. I think under either, I think the court would find that this statute is not facially unconstitutional. So, again, my position is rational, but I'm not convinced the court would find it even under the intermediate level.
Does a finding of mental illness include a concept of dangerousness? So the finding that the person is mentally ill by the jury or analysis by the medical persons is not a finding of dangerousness.
No, Your Honor. In fact, those doctor's reports, although they're part of the record, unless I've had that doctor testify, it's not really even something the judge should be considering. Now, in Dr. Musnero's case, he did testify, so a lot of the information he had in his report was part of the court's record. But the other report that was done is, again, it's information that's being obtained, and I would argue that it's information, that this whole process, including the appointment of counsel, is information that we are, to some extent, bombarding this inmate with to help him understand that, in fact, it's not just this one psychiatrist who thinks you've got a mental illness. It's not this one psychiatrist and the psychologist. Now we've got two more doctors and a judge also saying that you've got that. Hopefully, with the right attorney, that point can be made, and I would hope that we would want that inmate to seek treatment voluntarily.
Here's what bothers me. As I understand it, various reports, both in Wisconsin and nationally, indicate a fairly high percent of people that are in criminal justice corrections have mental illness. I mean, that's a wide range of illness, too. And why should or does person get committed? Why isn't, I mean, we agree that that you take care of the person includes mental health treatment, and you might be found negligent or intentionally harming the person if you don't give or offer treatment, right?
Correct.
So, I mean, the prison system is caught. On the one hand, they have an obligation to take care of the person, right? On the other hand, the person has rights for himself or herself, right? That's the tension.
Right.
Why do you have to commit somebody to give them mental health treatment? Why isn't it just part of each institution's obligations. I mean, just like training people in an institution to do auto mechanic work or computer skills or barber skills or what, or getting an associate degree, you do that by institution and individual choice.
I totally agree that we should be attempting to do that regardless of the commitment process. I don't disagree with that at all. I think what I would view AR is frankly kind of our last ditch effort, because clearly in AR we've already tried all those things and we've been unsuccessful. So it's somewhat the last ditch effort to again persuade them that perhaps, you know, treatment on a voluntary basis would be a good thing. Now, granted, we have had the advantage of Chapter 51.61, sub 1, sub G, which does permit the involuntary administration of treatment and medications. In the event the individual meets those standards, that's not before the court today. I think we've clarified that pretty well. But I have had the advantage of the use of that statute. If this court chooses to give us further direction, I'd be happy to see that.
Further direction, do you think?
Well, if this court felt that 51.61 should not be used unless there was some sort of finding of dangerousness, that would be useful. As it stands, of course, again, this is not before the court, but as it stands, it's absolutely true. There is no necessity to find dangerousness in order to find an individual incompetent as to medications, as our two statutes sitting separately are situated.
So the system can deal with that you have to have a finding of dangerousness to commit onto AR. Is that what you hear?
Well,
that's what I'm hearing you saying. If I'm wrong, tell me.
I don't think that isn't probably where I would put it. I might put it in 5161 if I was going to put it anywhere.
That's the treatment section,
because I don't see any deficiency in AR at this time. I think it's an appropriate statute. In fact, now, again, my time is up. I had an inmate argue on Wednesday. I was telling this to Ms. Lamb, who was arguing that I was violating his constitutional rights because I was committing him under Section 51, sub 1, sub A, one of the dangerousness sections, and he was arguing that I was violating his rights because he wasn't getting all of those things that AR provides him, the exact opposite of what we're dealing with today, and that was just on Wednesday.
Counsel, I'd like you to address in part response in Harper. I understood that the Harper Court, the United States Supreme Court, says, given the requirements of the prison environment, the Due Process Clause permits the state to treat a prison inmate who has a serious mental illness with antipsychotic drugs against his will if the inmate is dangerous. So I'm not quite clear about what your opposing counsel said, that Harper dealt with someone who was competent. Maybe I misunderstood, but I want you to address that specifically, getting into your argument as to why Harper requires a finding of dangerousness on commitment.
Well, I think I wasn't quite clear about that argument either, but I do think, as you were saying, that the point of Harper is that because of the bodily intrusion here, you're forcing drugs against somebody's will, that they do require both the mental illness plus the dangerous component. And I would note here, my understanding too of the county's argument is they seem to be conceding that medication needs to be dangerousness to administer the medication, if I understood that correctly. But I would note, at least under Wisconsin law, before you can even get to that question, while it is a separate statute, separate order, you still need the commitment in terms of long-term medication. So there'd have to be either a probable cause finding or a final hearing before you can get to that medication question. And so for that reason, it seems as well, just under the case law, that the commitment would also require the finding of dangerousness.
How do you deal with our Wood case, then?
Well, Wood case, I think Wood specifically indicated that in terms of the not guilty by reason of insanity, there's different interests involved there in terms of getting those individuals released out into the community. And so Wood specifically stated that prisons may have different interests than, say, not guilty by reason insanity or, a facility that's solely dealing with those individuals. Additionally, there, I think the court in Wood pretty explicitly noted that when it comes to NGI, there had been a finding, a connection between the mental illness and the crime. I mean, the person is saying that the mental illness is connected to the crime, whereas here there's, you know, no connection between mental illness and necessarily dangerous just because an individual is convicted. And so I think that Wood is distinguishable on that grounds, that there are different interests at stake than there are in this particular case. As I was talking about before, too, I think just the fact of a conviction, there's lots of people who are incarcerated for, say, forgery or embezzlement that might not necessarily fit those dangerousness criteria. And so under the case law, such a finding would be required. And I'm not saying either that inmates can never be committed. The court counsel or the county could certainly proceed under, as it sounds like had recently happened in opposing counsel's cases, they could proceed under one of those other criteria in order to commit the individual. And so I'm by no means suggesting that commitment and medication would be completely off the table. I'm just simply asking that this court find that there's something more that's required, that there needs to be some type of finding of dangerousness in order to commit a person. Additionally, I know there was discussion about the statistics. I know in 2009, I believe it was the Wisconsin's Legislative Audit Bureau released a study of prisons, and at that point, at least in 2008, there was about 22,000 people who were incarcerated, and 7,000 of those people were mentally ill.
How many?
7,000.
I'm sorry. Seven.
How many were committed?
I don't know the figure for how many were committed, but my point being that if there's 7,000 people who are believed to have a mental illness that are in prison, the statute basically allows commitments for all of those people, and so it's a large number without the finding of
guilt. Right, and so therefore, why would you think it's more rational for the state to respond to a mentally ill person who is suffering from, say, a complete break, psychotic break from reality, okay? Imagine how frightening that would be. And instead of civilly committing that person, the response of the prison system, from what I hear you saying, boils down to an endorsement of what Justice Prosser observed in his trip to the prison, where he saw mentally ill inmates shackled to tables, or as you said in response to my question earlier, well, the prison system has disciplinary procedures available to it to deal with the disruptive, which apparently would include those suffering from severe mental illness who would be experiencing something like a psychotic break by putting them into solitary confinement. Why would that be more rational?
Well, first of all, it seems that, as I indicated before, the United States Supreme Court says that just because somebody is mentally ill, you also need the finding of dangerousness. Additionally, if
right,
they are
and in Donaldson, what you didn't point out is there was no conviction of a crime in that case. So I'm not convinced that that's necessarily something we have to follow. But please go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, it seems, too, that if the person is so mentally ill that they are causing some type of harm to themselves.
Who said anything about harm? People experience psychotic breaks all the time, and they don't necessarily harm others.
And so it's my position that without there being some harm to themselves or harm to others, that it's not enough just to simply say because they are mentally ill that they have to have this medication forced upon them given the side effects.
We're talking about the commitment process.
Yes.
Talking about the medication statute, right?
Or committed against their will just because of the stigmas that are associated with commitment or the transfer to the, you know, Winnebago facility, that just because they're mentally ill, it's not enough to commit them under the law.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for fine arguments on a very interesting area of the law that, even though counsel has had a lot of experience, really hasn't come up before. So we thank you very much for bringing that to our attention so we can think about it and decide what to do with your arguments. We'll take a brief recess now so that people can leave the courtroom if they choose to, and then we'll be back in about 5 minutes to start with our second case for the morning. We are in recess. Thank you.